I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Over the course of the last 6 weeks, President Trump has removed or replaced five inspectors general whose job it is to be a watchdog and provide oversight of their respective agencies. Those agencies include intelligence, transportation, defense, health and human services, and as of last Friday night, the State Department when Steve Linnick was fired. Here's President Trump being asked about that firing on Monday in an edited clip from CNN when Trump says Mike, he's referring to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Explain, sir, why you decided to fire the Inspector General at the State Department?
I don't know him at all. I never even heard of him, but I was asked to by the State Department, by Mike. So I don't know him, never heard of him, but they asked me to terminate him. I have the absolute right as president to terminate. I said, who appointed him? And they said, President Obama. I said, look, I'll terminate him. I was happy to do it. Mike requested that I do it. He should have done it a long time ago, in my opinion. He's an Obama appointment, and he had some difficulty. But I just don't know who he is. I don't know. I never heard his name.
Linnick was investigating allegations that Pompeo and his wife used a government aide to do personal errands and the administration's sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia, which Congress had stopped. Congressman Elliot Engel of New York, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said the firing suggests that this is an unlawful act of retaliation. We asked Nihal Tusi to join us. She's foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Can you deconstruct the president's response to that question on Monday about why Linnick was fired?
Well, oftentimes when the president fires someone or someone gets pushed out, he claims he doesn't know them, has never heard of them. So I have a hard time believing that he had never heard of Steve Linnick, especially because Steve Linnick did play a minor role in the Ukraine impeachment scandal. But that being said, you know, from the beginning, this administration has been very hostile toward really anybody who was working in government when Barack Obama was president, including career officials and others who are not career government employees, but maybe political appointees who traditionally are allowed to stay on even when an administration changes, such as the FBI director. And inspectors general are among that group. It's a small group. They're government watchdogs. They act largely independently. They're often not liked by the agencies where they are conducting oversight. But in this case, yes, Linnick was an Obama appointee, and I guess Secretary Pompeo just, for a number of reasons, was unhappy with him, and the president agreed to remove him.
You mentioned that Linnick played a minor role in the Ukraine scandal. I want to try to piece all these pieces together. What was that role?
Well, you know, as this whole impeachment investigation was ongoing, he suddenly asked to meet with lawmakers, and he took to them a packet of documents that included some highly questionable kind of smear campaign conspiracy type materials on two figures involved in the scandal, including a former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and Hunter Biden, the son of former Vice President Joe Biden. The materials were, from everything we gathered, not particularly that great, but Linnick felt like he had to turn them over. And just to be clear, the materials had been given to the State Department by Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal lawyer. So this material had kind of come from Rudy, gone to the State Department, was handed over to Linnick, and then Linnick, as this impeachment scandal was unfolding, felt like he had to give it to the lawmakers and make sure they were aware that this exchange had happened.
Like Congressman Schiff, people like that?
Yes, yes. Although, again, you know, even Democrats just looked at it and were like, this is kind of weird stuff, and we don't think it makes that much of a difference. But it got a ton of attention at the time.
We heard the president say, I have the right to fire an inspector general, including this inspector general. Is he correct about that?
Yes, he can. But he's supposed to give Congress 30 days notification. He's supposed to give them a reason. But at the end of the day, from legal scholars that I've talked to, and I've written about these in the past, the president has a lot of authority over firing and hiring inspectors general. The thing is that normally they don't do it, you know, because they know that it looks bad to fire someone who's acting as a watchdog. And without real evidence of egregious misconduct or something, presidents just generally don't touch IGs. They leave them there. There's no term limit as far as I know, so the IGs just kind of stay as long as they want and then they retire. But no, you know, the president has not paid attention to a lot of norms. And so this is another one.
We have a couple of clicks on your phone line. I'm hoping that we can get beyond that and continue our conversation. Let's talk a little bit about Linick's time at the State Department. He came in under the Obama administration. He was also, and this goes back a couple of years, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, or perhaps when she was running for president, he investigated her use of a private server and her email. And that was a pretty big topic when it came to her bid for the presidency. He concluded she didn't comply with public records laws. So it seems like he wasn't afraid to criticize her or perhaps even Obama.
That's right. I mean, he was not particularly well-liked by the Obama administration because he did do some really tough reports. You know, sometimes people felt like he was always looking for, you know, things to ding them on. But I was told by Obama administration officials that he also was very transparent with them. And, you know, he told them what he was working on. He gave them opportunities to respond. And the Clinton email thing was a big one. I mean, he issued a report that really, you know, took aim at her, said she showed mm-hmm. poor judgment in having a private server, which I think even a lot of Democrats agree with. And, you know, so, no, he wasn't popular. But frankly, inspectors general are rarely beloved. They may be respected, but I've never heard of one being, you know, really liked by the people whose work he is sifting through and looking to see if he catches anything that's wrong.
I mean, you don't want a phone call from the inspector general, correct?
Correct. Except I will say I would love one this morning from him.
I bet you would, yes. You don't work at the State Department.
I do apologize for all the clicks and the noises on my phone, but I'm very popular this morning. I'm literally about to break a story on this whole issue. And so, yeah, but I would love it if Linick would call me.
Well, do you want to break something on Radio Times?
I think I better wait till my publication breaks it. But let's just say that there's a lot to this. I mean, it's not just one thread. There was a lot going on with Linick. It's the people he was investigating at the State Department. And, you know, it seems to me like over time, Secretary of State Pompeo just got really kind of frustrated with all these different investigations. And I don't know what was the straw that broke the camel's back, but, you know, we're still digging.
Well, I'm going to dig as much as I can with you, Nihal Tusi, to find out what you know. But let me just quickly reintroduce you. And she's foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. And we asked her to join us on Radio Times to talk about the fact that late Friday, the inspector general at the State Department, a guy named Steve Linick, was fired by the president and apparently fired because the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, wanted it to happen. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Nihal, one of the allegations is that he was looking into Mike Pompeo and his wife and the fact that they were apparently or allegedly using a political person to do some personal errands. What do we know about this?
Yes, well, there's a lot to this, but basically, in a nutshell, there were complaints that an aide to the Pompeos, a woman named Coney Porter, who has worked for Pompeo for, you know, a long time, well before he even joined the Trump administration, that they kind of relied on her to, you know, do a range of things that maybe were not really State Department business. And also, it may not have just been her, but, you know, the idea is like, oh, somebody picked up their Chinese food or their dry cleaning. But to be quite frank, like, from my understanding, like, those things are small, and frankly, a lot of secretaries of state, you know, they can't necessarily go to pick up their dry cleaning because they're in meetings all day with diplomats and they need someone to do that. And those things are not really considered egregious. So the question is, and people are looking into this, is what more did Ms. Porter and others do that perhaps, you know, blurred the lines? And one story that, you know, we heard about last night, this is something I've been looking into, but to their credit, NBC News beat me to the punch. They talked about how there was a lot of organization of so-called Madison dinners. These were dinners, kind of extravagant dinners that the Pompeos hosted for influential figures, you know, from diplomats to country music stars, and they were roughly once a month at the State Department. And there were a lot of State Department officials who felt like this was not a proper use of resources, that it wasn't necessarily advancing U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, the question is, was this a way for the Pompeos to build up their political connections ahead of what many believe is Secretary Pompeo's plans to run for president in 2024? And so if his aides were helping him organize these dinners, you know, that might have reflected it as well. And just doing other things that maybe were more political in nature, such as arranging trips for Secretary Pompeo to go visit Kansas for public events, you know, that weren't really diplomatic. But the challenge is these things are really blurry and there's this gray area, right? Like, you could argue that going to Kansas and giving a speech about how wonderful the State Department is does advance U.S. foreign policy, right? So it's one of those things that I think they're going to have a hard time ultimately saying, you know, there was clear violation, but there's no question that, you know, it feels a little yucky in a lot of ways.
There were also apparently criticisms that Mike Pompeo's wife, Susan Pompeo, would travel with him and I guess in some of these diplomatic events or missions. Is that unusual? Is that something that's being investigated?
So, yes, her travel is part of this. Now, is it unusual? It is unusual, but that's partly because the last several secretaries of state we've had, their spouses, you know, either have been, well, you know, either they haven't had spouses or their spouses has been an ex-president, which is a bit unusual,
right.
Or the spouse, such as Secretary Kerry's spouse, was sick and couldn't necessarily travel with him. But the idea of a spouse traveling with the Secretary of State is not unprecedented. George Shultz, for instance, his wife, late wife, traveled with him all the time. And so this is very much kind of a contested thing. Some people say it's great that she travels with him now and then. She can go talk to the diplomat's family. She can, you know, talk to, I was told, for instance, she's able to talk to the wives of Arab leaders, you know, whereas the Secretary of State doesn't really get a chance to meet those folks. And she's able to glean some things about the relationship that maybe a Secretary of State could not. And so some saw her as very much an asset, but others felt like, look, you know, she's one more person we have to staff. She's one more person we have to, whose schedule we have to deal with, and she's not a diplomat. So why are we doing this? Again, it's one of those gray areas, but yeah, this is all part of the investigation.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and we are talking about the firing last Friday of the State Department's Inspector General, a guy named Steve Linick, and it's raising a whole host of questions about what's been happening at the State Department. We're going to take a short break, continue our conversation, and we do want to talk about Saudi Arabia and an arms deal there and how that might figure into this as well. And again, you can join us, Radio Times, at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us at 1-888-477-9499. This is your government at work. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Just a recap here. Last Friday, President Trump, at the urging of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, fired the State Department's Inspector General, a guy named Steve Linick. We've been talking about some allegations that he was investigating Pompeo and his wife using a political staffer to do personal errands. There are also suggestions that the move was done in order to silence an investigation into the administration's sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia. I should add that we'll be talking with Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, in about 10 minutes, talking in more detail about U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia. But in the meantime, let me pick up with you, Nahal Tusi, again, Politico reporter, about this whole Saudi Arabia investigation and I guess even the arms sale. CNN reported that Pompeo refused to sit for an interview with the IG, with the inspector general, about the administration's essentially bypassing Congress in order to sell arms to Saudi Arabia. What do we know so far?
So point of pride here. Actually, I was the one who broke that.
Oh, CNN, I am so sorry.
That's my story.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. It's just, you know, like the reporter.
Everyone's all over this story, but yes, no, I appreciate that. Thank you for that correction.
It is hard to keep track. No. But like, yeah, I mean, basically the inspector general, their inspections unit was looking into this question of the Saudi arms transfer. And this caused a lot of anger in Congress because they're very unhappy with the way Saudi Arabia has pursued the war in Yemen, and they've been trying to regulate these arms transfers more. And so the secretary basically declared a state of emergency or an emergency declaration and tried to bypass Congress and did effectively to sell these weapons to the Saudis. Now, the IG was looking into whether this was done appropriately or not. But my understanding is that, you know, he wouldn't sit down for an interview. And the thing is that in theory, this inspector general has access to everything and everyone in the department. And so a secretary, in theory, can't refuse an interview. But the New York Times reported yesterday that although he did refuse the interview, he did agree to submit written answers to written questions. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I couldn't tell if that has already been done or if they're still working on that. But that, you know, is really not the same thing as an interview, because you can get your lawyer to look at the answers and you can write them in a way, and Pompeo is especially adept at this, you know, write them in a way that pass legal scrutiny, but which, you know, are not really truthful in spirit. And it just sent another signal that, you know, something was going on with that. And it, to me, it's just one more thing that made Pompeo unhappy with the inspector general.
Well, I'm curious, too, and perhaps this gets too much into the weeds. So by declaring an emergency from the administration's perspective, that allowed them to do a runaround around essentially Congress's halt or ban on these arms sales?
Essentially, yes. I mean, there's, you know, provisions in certain laws that say they try to give the president some flexibility. And the Trump administration has been very good at taking advantage of these provisions, saying something's an emergency. For instance, we have to help the Saudis. We have to sell them these weapons because they're one of our main allies against Iran, which the Trump administration views as the top enemy in the Middle East.
Where do things stand now? And I know some members of Congress are pushing back, including people like Senator Grassley and some other Republicans who are saying we need to take a further look at what this is about. Where does that stand?
Well, Democrats are furious. And there are Senator Bob Menendez and Elliot Engel, Representative Elliot Engel, are working together on a joint investigation into this IG firing. Republicans have, I would say push back would be a generous term. Mm-hmm. Senator Grassley has requested more information on why President Trump fired this inspector general. Senator Grassley has done that in the past for past IG firing, and he's never gotten a response from the administration. So I don't know that this time is going to be any different. Senator Mitt Romney, who basically is kind of in exile from the GOP right now, he has voiced concern, but he doesn't really have any power, and neither does Senator Susan Collins, who's also voiced concern. And then the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Jim Risch, made this weird statement. To be honest, it didn't really say anything, so I'm not even sure why I'm bringing it up. This is not anything meaningful. But you know, one person who does have some power, he's chairing a committee or a subcommittee, is Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin. And he said that, you know, he talked to the White House and he's not crying any crocodile tears over Linux firing, and that he's basically fine with it. So, you know, seeing as the Senate has a lot of power, and the Republicans have control of the Senate, I don't see them being able to really mount a comeback. And even the joint investigation by the Democrats, they've requested information from the State Department, and the State Department notoriously just ignores those requests for information. So,
wow. Carolyn from Malvern says, we need IGs to safeguard taxpayer money. I'm a nurse and we have inspectors too. They are necessary. I mean, a lot of organizations have that. They're ombudsmen that work for journalist organizations to make sure that people stay on the straight and narrow path.
That's right. I mean, these are people, you know, we call them watchdogs, we call them oversight. And the thing about inspectors general in the government is, you know, they are supposed to adhere to certain standards, certain rules and regulations governing audits and investigations. So they have a very rigorous standard that they have to adhere to. Plus, you know, when they do issue an investigation or do an investigation, they give the agency or the targets of the investigation an opportunity to respond. They give them a lot of time to respond. They include their responses in their final report. Plus, they usually include something like best practices. Like, the point of an IG isn't to just, you know, beat people over the head. The point is to say, look, we didn't do this right this time. Here's what we're going to do next time. Here's what you should do. It's about kind of improving things, helping an agency get better, helping people understand. When an IG does their job well, you know, an agency ends up having less waste, fraud, and abuse. I think there are also other watchdog organizations that, you know, inside the government that we don't hear as much of, like the Office of Special Counsel, which is different from Bob Mueller. And, you know, it's possible that there's investigations going on that we don't even know about, because much of what they do is really very secret until they release the final report.
Wow. Who does an inspector general then answer to? I mean, they're delivering reports, they're making recommendations, they're offering criticism. Are they answerable to Congress, to the White House, or are they their sort of own independent entity?
They're very independent for the most part. Technically, as we've described, the president can fire them. Congress sometimes, you know, very rarely, but sometimes gets really frustrated with an IG, and that leads the president to fire an IG. It's, again, rare, but it has happened. And the other thing is they have their own mechanism. There's something called the Council of Inspectors General for Integrity and Ethics, CIGI, and it's like their own internal watchdog, essentially. It's the watchdog for the watchdogs. But wow. I've looked into CIGI in the past, and to be really frank, they don't have much teeth. So you really, when you hire an IG, you really do want to hire someone who has a lot of integrity.
About a minute or so before we have to say goodbye to you. So there's, I guess the acting IG is a guy named Stephen Achard. What do we know about him? And who does the president want to replace Linick?
Stephen Achard is a former Foreign Service officer. He did a stint of about 8 years quite a while back. More recently from that, he became an aide to Vice President Pence when he was governor of Indiana. And then when the Trump administration took power, they tried to bring him in at the State Department at a very high level as the head of basically human resources for the Foreign Service. The Foreign Service officials just retaliated. They felt like he did not have the seniority to have such a high-profile job. So he didn't get that job, but he was given another position at the State Department, the head of the Office of Foreign Missions. It's kind of a logistical office, is my understanding of it. And now, you know, again, he's basically a Pence ally, someone that they feel they can trust, this administration. And they're putting him in charge of the IG's office. And this is going to be a really interesting test because, you know, what reports is he going to kill? What reports, what investigations will he pursue, if any? Is the IG's office basically just going to be rendered, you know, ineffective and immobile? Or is he going to actually act like an independent watchdog? I'm going to certainly be watching closely.
Well, I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times, Nahal Tusi. Thanks so much. And she's foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Apparently you're going to have a big story coming out, which you did not want to tell us about, but I appreciate you joining us, giving us all this background. It's such an important issue.
It's not a huge story, but it pushes things forward.
Okay, so very good. Well, I will be looking for it. No, thank you so much, Nahal, for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Take care.
You too. And we have been talking about Friday's firing of Steve Linick, the State Department's Inspector General. President Trump said he made the call at the suggestion of Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. One of the investigations Linick was reportedly conducting involved a $7 billion sale of arms to Saudi Arabia last year over the objections of Congress. Now, Congress had halted the sale several years ago when American-made bomb fragments traced to Raytheon were found at a site that killed scores of civilians civilians in Yemen. Members of Congress were also outraged by the murder of Saudi critic and Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The CIA concluded that the Saudi crown prince Mohammed bin Salman personally ordered Khashoggi's death, something the prince denies. We're here to talk about all of this is Joe Cirincione. He's president of the Plowshares Fund, and that's a global security foundation. He's also the host of Press the Button, a podcast that comes from the Plowshares Fund, and it deals with nuclear policy and national security. Joe Cirincione, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can always join our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, let's begin with the firing of Steve Linnick, the State Department's Inspector General. Joe, what's your overall response to that?
Well, it was very clear that the Inspector General was getting a little too close to some of Mike Pompeo's activities. There are actually three interrelated scandals that apparently Linnick was looking at. One involves something that's dogged Pompeo throughout his career, which is the alleged use of government employees for personal errands, like walking the dog or picking up his dry cleaning. That was one that came up even during Mike Pompeo's tenure at CIA and then during his confirmation hearing. The second, which just broke last night by NBC News, is a series of dinners that apparently the Secretary of State was holding at the very fancy seventh floor dining room of the State Department that apparently had nothing to do with State Department functions or little to do, and more to do with, as NBC News reported, cultivating a network of political and corporate supporters for the secretary. There's never been a series of dinners like this in the history of the State Department, and that's something else the Inspector General was looking into. But the most important investigation is the one involving the Saudi arms deal. Yeah. That's because it was an $8 billion deal, quite a lot of money, and it was arms that the Saudis and their allies, the United Arab Emirates, were using to conduct their war against Yemen. These are precision-guided munitions built largely by Raytheon, but also by Lockheed Martin. And the sales had been blocked after the Saudi assassination of the dissident Jamal Khashoggi last year. Congress had stopped these sales. Mike Pompeo pushed through an emergency declaration with President Trump's support, of course. The president has to declare this emergency, saying that there was an urgent Iranian threat to Saudi Arabia that required these sales to go through, that circumvented normal checks and balances by the Congress. It waived, for example, the normal 30-day waiting period. And it turns out, and this is what the Inspector General was investigating, that there was no emergency, that there was no new activity that justified this. And he also started looking very closely at the role of a certain employee at the State Department, a principal deputy assistant secretary of state, Charles Faulkner, who was a former top Raytheon lobbyist and was apparently one of the chief engineers of pushing this arms sales through. So all those investigations were getting closer and closer to Mike Pompeo. It appears that's why the Secretary of State asked that Mr. Lichtner be fired, and President Trump quickly complied.
Well, let me follow up on a couple of those things that you just raised there, Joe. There's a Trump quote that goes back to 2018, and I guess this is when Congress was putting the brakes on selling arms to the Saudis. Trump said, "I want Boeing, Lockheed, and Raytheon to take these orders, hire lots of people to make that incredible equipment," obviously talking about arms. And this is not the first time the United States has been in the arms deal business. That's something that we do. But how significant do you think is that quote?
Oh, well, it clearly shows, you know, President Trump's priorities and, in fact, the overall attitude of his administration, including with Secretary Pompeo, which is this is about making money for large corporations. This is you can look at that two ways. One is just the petty, corrupt nature of that I'm here to help facilitate these deals for my corporate buddies, the people that fund my campaigns, that are my supporters, that are my base. The other is you could take a somewhat more benign view and say that this is really about making money for America, that this is good for American business. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in a, what's good for Lockheed Martin, what's good for Raytheon is good for America. Either way, however, either of those two interpretations mean that Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo are trampling over other American values, such as respect for human rights, such as trying to avoid wars rather than to stoke them. And they're giving up any leverage that they have over Saudi behavior, for example, in trying to get the Saudis to improve their domestic record, their treatment of women, their, for example, by just giving them carte blanche on arms sales. So number one, sell weapons. Everything else is a distant second in that analysis.
Well, Joe, let me just do a quick follow-up there, because President Obama backed sales of arms to Saudi Arabia. What's the difference?
Well, it's a very good point. Very good point. This is pretty standard American practice, and it shows some of the flaws in our system that all too often arms sales take precedent over human rights, over environmental concerns, over other issues we might have. And, you know, somebody who's worked in Washington for 35 years in national security, I certainly see this. There is tremendous pressure to make the sale, to sell the weapons. What Trump did is, in a sense, is just more blatant, and he did it, and he completely trumped any human rights considerations, in this case, holding the Saudis accountable for the brutal slaying and dismemberment of Mr. Khashoggi. You know, the Congress, here's what's different. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, you got Republicans and Democrats in the House and in the Senate to vote together to stop the arms sales. So it shows how far this policy went from even the normal arms sales, the normal everyday corruption of our government process. When you get the House and the Senate to say, no, don't do this, they passed a law blocking the sales. Trump vetoed that law, and there was enough Republican votes to sustain the veto. So that gives you some idea of how far outside the norm this was.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Joe Cirincione. He's the president of the Plowshares Fund, and we are talking about a complicated story, a very important one involving arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. It's our fallen policy we're talking about.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Joe Cirincione. Again, he's the president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation. He also has a podcast called Press the Button from the Plowshares Fund, and it deals with nuclear policy and national security. We are talking about national security and arms sales to Saudi Arabia, even in defiance of a congressional ban. And Joe, as I was reading the articles in preparation for today's show, I was reminded of the Iran-Contra affair. It's not a perfect analogy, but this was a secret U.S. arms deal. We traded missiles and arms to free Americans. They were held hostage by terrorists in Lebanon. Lebanon had ties to Iran, and then that money was used for funding on, arms for the fighters in Nicaragua. It was a violation of the Boland Amendment. It almost brought down the presidency of Ronald Reagan. But do you see some comparison to Iran-Contra?
Well, in the case of Iran-Contra, and I was, it's funny, I was in Washington then working on these, on Latin American issues in the 1980s at this time.
Yeah,
I'm pretty old. In that case, it was a secret arms deal where Ronald Reagan was trying to win favor with the Iranians by getting them some arms, by getting them arms, and then using the money from those sales to fund an illegal operation in Central America. It was a pretty complicated triangular deal.
Yep.
This is much more simple. This is straight out contractor profits. This is straight out helping Raytheon sell weapons to the Saudis, which they are then using in a very brutal multi-year war against the people of Yemen. Just this weekend, there was a terrific front-page story in the New York Times documenting how these weapons are used and how they get there and the kinds of machinations that the defense lobbyists go through to encourage these sales. And these are weapons that are supposedly precision-guided, but that doesn't mean that the targets they're very accurate at hitting their targets, but that doesn't mean that they choose the targets well. They've been involved in cases at, for example, at open-air markets that have killed scores of individuals, a very tragic incident just last year. A school bus was hit. 45 school children were killed. And so there are hundreds and hundreds of civilian casualties from these weapons. And the contractors who make them are mainly interested in their profits. So this particular deal was an $8 billion deal, but it's only one small slice of the kinds of deals that are involved, the kinds of money that are involved. And these people tend to be the corporate backers of Mike Pompeo, of Donald Trump. So there's a very incestuous, corrupt relationship that's going on here. And that's why this inspector general's investigation was so serious. It wasn't just a mere sort of, you know, violation of the letter of the law. There was no emergency, so therefore you shouldn't have issued an emergency declaration. It gets at the overall nature of the kind of operation we're seeing with this current government.
My understanding, too, Mark Esper, who is the Secretary of Defense, was the chief lobbyist for Raytheon back in his civilian days.
Yes, that's right. Raytheon has quite a presence in the current government. They've always been a strong force. I had my own tangles with Raytheon when I was investigating the performance of the Patriot missile in the Gulf War back in the 1990s when I was on staff of the Government Operations Committee. So I have a very close-up view of how these guys work, and they're very, very good at what they do. In this case, there's even a closer connection with the State Department. There's a gentleman named Charles Faulkner, who was a top Raytheon lobbyist, and he was the principal deputy assistant secretary of state during this time, and apparently was very influential in arranging this deal and arranging this, what we now know as a phony emergency declaration. He was then forced to resign a year ago, May 2019, as a result of the uproar about this emergency declaration, and he was forced to resign. Interestingly, quietly, about 4 months later, he was rehired. He's now chief of staff at the Homeland Security Agency, still working on these issues.
I mentioned in my introduction, and this is the horrifying murder of Jamal Khashoggi. He was apparently dismembered at a Saudi embassy. Was it in Turkey, I believe.
Yes, that's right. He was going to Turkey with his fiancée. He just needed clearances. They were planning to get married. He just needed to pick up a piece of paper. He was lured into the embassy. He never came out.
Yeah. The CIA, though, apparently concluded that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was personally responsible for his death by ordering his death. So here we've got, you know, a part of the government that at least is calling out the Crown Prince, but kind of silence from the White House and from others in government.
Yes, that's exactly right. The evidence from multiple sources, including our own intelligence agencies and other intelligence agencies and the Turkish government, clearly indicate that Mohammed bin Salman was personally involved in this, that these were his people that he sent, including the famous Saudi official who brought a bone saw to the meeting that apparently was used to dismember Mr. Khashoggi. So there's a personal connection with Mohammed bin Salman, and then that makes this scandal even more serious. Apparently, the inspector general was also looking into what role Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, played in arranging this phony emergency declaration, and whether Kushner was in direct contact with Mohammed bin Salman to arrange this sale to get this money flowing. So you can see this starts to almost unravel like a complicated movie plot, where what seems like just a simple arms deal ends up entangling the president's own family in what may be a deeply corrupt and illegal setup. So that gives new urgency to why the Congress has to look as closely as they can at this Lichtner following. Fortunately, Representative Engel, the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, does seem to be on the case, does seem to be pursuing it. In fact, the initial investigation into the Saudi arms deal was begun at Mr. Engel's request. He's been sporadically following it. He appears to be focused on it now.
Do you see Republican buy-in on that investigation or others?
Well, as you know, the Republican bloc with the president is quite strong. It's very, very difficult to get any Republican to criticize anything that this president does. But in this case, there were enough Republicans that block to vote on the legislation that passed the House and then passed the Senate and went to the president's desk. So you do have Republicans concerned about this, about the Khashoggi murder, about the arms sales, about the slaughter that they're seeing in Yemen at the hands of the Saudis. Whether that translates into pursuing an investigation against the president in an election year, I doubt it.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to change the topic for a moment or two. That's Joe Cirincione again. He's the president of the Plowshares Fund, and we are talking about foreign policy, national security, arms sales to Saudi Arabia. You know, everything is pandemic-related these days for all the obvious reasons, and we've focused a lot on just the impact domestically, economically, socially, you know, financially in almost every way, health-wise, every way that you possibly can. But I'm wondering, Joe, from your perspective, how do you see that pandemic changing U.S. foreign policy around the world?
I think the coronavirus is going to fundamentally change our priorities here in America and our view of what our real threats are. And you already see this happening. In just the last 6-7 weeks, there's been over a dozen different articles or statements from leading foreign policy, national security experts, both Republicans and Democrats, about how coronavirus is changing our definition of national security. For example, Max Boot, a defense hawk, self-described defense hawk, a real proponent of the invasion of Iraq, wrote in the Washington Post on March 31st that the threats we face now have nothing to do with military threats. We shouldn't be spending as much money as we are on the military budget. We have to take care of these disinformation attacks, for example, by the Russians, the pandemics, and climate change. Ben Rhodes, deputy national security advisor for Barack Obama, writes in The Atlantic last month an article along exactly the same line. Samantha Power, the former U.N. ambassador, writes along the same way. Jessica Matthews, former head of the Carnegie Endowment, big piece in the New York Review of Books, even last year, talking about how we have to close this chapter, this militarization of U.S. foreign policy that we've had for the last 19 years since the attacks of September 11th. And you have to realize, you know, we had a budget, a military budget that went from $300 billion before September 11th, $300 billion, to $750 billion now. And for what? Do you feel safer? Do you feel more secure? Have we accomplished any of our goals? You know, in the war, how do you feel about the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the Saudi support for the Saudi war in Yemen? It's all same. It's all part of the same piece. And you see this drive now to say enough, enough. We've been the reason we're having such a terrible response to the corona pandemic is because we've been under resourcing the real parts of the American government that address our real threats. For example, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Just yesterday, 29 Democrats, leading Democrats in the House of Representatives, sent a letter to the leadership calling for cuts to this year's Defense Authorization Act. Wow. The president wants $750 billion for the Pentagon, and they're saying, look, we have to take some of that money and buy fewer weapons and move it towards the pandemic, buy fewer planes and tanks and spend less on the wars abroad and spend more on addressing the recession, perhaps depression, this country's about to go through. So that this movement is building, this redefinition is building. I think it's a very touchy issue for politicians to take up in an election year. Traditionally, they want to appear strong on defense. But what does strong mean now? What does it mean to be strong? Does it mean pushing through $8 billion worth of arms sales to Saudi Arabia? Does it mean pushing up the military budget? Or does it mean providing needed resources to families who are on the edge, who can't afford to pay their mortgage, pay their rent, who are having trouble buying food right now? What does it mean to be strong? I think we're about to go through a process in this country where we have a fundamental redefinition of national security, of national strength.
Well, that's interesting, and I think it just needs to be said that when you look at our meaning the United States response to the pandemic, is that we have done worse than a lot of countries. We are, we're way behind South Korea. We're way behind Germany. There are other countries as well that have been able to get on top of this crisis, and we're still dragging our feet and fighting with each other.
Yeah, and this is not a matter of ideology. It's not like liberal countries did well and autocratic countries did bad, although there is some correlation. But you had, you know, countries like Taiwan and Singapore do much better, as well as New Zealand and yeah. Australia, you know, do much better. We have a third of all the coronavirus deaths in the world. One third of all the people who have died from this virus have died here in America. We do not have one third of the world's population. We do. There's a failure of leadership, but there's also a failure of our system that goes beyond President Trump. President Trump has been particularly incompetent, particularly inept, but we also were unprepared for this because we've been spending on the wrong things for far too long.
Ellen emails, I wish all the media would bring up Trump's personal financial interests overlapping with U.S. policy, Saudi Arabia, China, Turkey. That's probably only the beginning of the list. I don't know, Joe, if you've got the time or the ability to respond to that, but how much do you think the president's personal financial interests then are driving foreign policy?
President Trump has substantial financial relationship with Saudi Arabia, as does his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. His very first overseas trip was to Saudi Arabia. First time a president has done that. You may remember that famous photo of him with his hands on the glowing globe with the leaders of Saudi Arabia. I think there's very little doubt that his policy towards Saudi Arabia is directly related to his interest in making money for his personal, for his family business with Saudi Arabia. It's the kind of thing that you would think there'd be a president would respect, the sort of conflict of interest laws, would just divest himself from any business interests with such an important American partner such as Saudi Arabia, but he has not. He flaunts these laws. I'm afraid that the profit motive has a lot more to do with U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia than any genuine U.S. national security interests.
We are in an election year. We're almost out of time. But do you think Congress, the government is going to disinvest from arms sales and building up the Pentagon?
I think you see this wave building. But never underestimate the power of the defense industry. You know, Elizabeth Warren campaigned on the fact that our military procurement system was corrupt. She said that our military policy, our defense policy, is determined by the top five defense contractors. I happen to agree with her. I think that's true. That's the way I see it. There are 727 lobbyists in Washington working for defense contractors, 727. They spend about $130 million a year lobbying Congress. That is a very powerful force, and that's not even counting defense contributions. If you want to know what determines our defense policy, look at the contracts. And follow the money, as they say, follow the money. This is a very formidable force, but it may have met its match in the pandemic. That what the pandemic is doing to this country is so profound, so deep, and the needs that we have, non-military needs, are so strong that it may be enough to break the grip of even the powerful defense lobby in Washington.
Well, Joe Cirincione, thank you, as always, for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much. And he's the president of the Plowshares Fund. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. We got lots of podcasts that you can check out and other features as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.